rest of the planet's 800 million people lived underwater, in domes that protected them from the vicious elements of Ambrose's surface, but were reputably quite comfortable and well-appointed. From those domes, Ambrose's population had access to some extraordinarily rich deposits of transuranics, as well as the strange and wonderful wildlife of an ocean that had spent 4 billion years above those transuranics. Other than that one wet but habitable world, Presley was a whirling mess of a star system. It didn't have asteroid belts so much as the entire system had a mobile rock infestation. Ambrose's large moon protected the world from most of the potential problems, but there was a reason most of the planet's life was underwater. A single undersized gas giant, Anderson, orbited outside the swarm of rocks that probably had been several rocky inner worlds before some kind of planetary-scale catastrophe had occurred. A single lonely cloud scoop in its orbit provided fuel to the orbital platforms tucked under the protective cloak of Ambrose's moon. Those platforms, however, made the Presley system one of the more important in this region of space. Mass manipulators were required for starships to function at all. They played games with the mass of both fuel and ship to allow for efficient acceleration, played other games to create gravity fields, and did 1,000 other minor chores essential to modern technology. And that was before getting into the big ones required for Alcubierre-Stetson drives. Mass manipulators were built around carefully calibrated coils of exotic matter. That exotic matter was a massive endeavor to produce, and the factories that did so had a voracious appetite for exactly the transuranics that were so common on Ambrose's ocean floor. The chaotic swarm of meteors and asteroids that filled the inner system made Presley an unwise place to put shipyards or even large exotic matter coil production facilities, so Presley didn't build starship coils or starships. There was no military production here, and Presley didn't fuel the Niagara Fleet Base at all. The facilities in Presley, however, produced something like 3% of the exotic matter coils used in civilian industries in the Commonwealth.
"I never visited the surface," Sterling admitted. "I came through here as part of a merchant venture about 15 years back, buying exotic matter coils for civilian industry."
He shrugged.
"They were cheap and high quality, so we imported them. Made sure none of them went to military applications," he noted with a grin, then shook his head as the smile faded. "Feels weird to come back here like this."
"It should," Kyle told him.
"In any case, this meteor cloud is making me nervous. It's not a threat, but it'll make it far too easy for the locals to hide from us. Anything out there in terms of starships?"
"Negative," Aurangzeb replied. "I'm picking up 6 Zions in orbit, but that's it."
"That's it?"
"That can't be right," the Admiral replied. "This system should have a lot more than that."
"A lot more?" "They had more," Sterling added. "When I was here, they had at least 20 defensive platforms. Not Zions, older platforms, but still."
"Get the CSP up," Kyle ordered. "And everyone keep your eyes open. Something stinks, and I don't think it's the fish."
"There was a mutiny,"
Commander Isol Vasilev said softly. Kyle's dark-haired and petite intelligence officer rarely spoke any other way.
"About 22 months ago, the orbital defense platforms went rogue, seizing control of their systems and declaring a new independent republic. The local populace went along quickly enough that the Commonwealth thinks it was all prearranged. It didn't save anyone, not with Walking Stick and the Niagara Fleet Base barely a week's travel away," she concluded. "The entire orbital defense matrix was destroyed, and a pacification corps was deployed." Vasilev shivered. "Communications out of the system had been badly restricted, and our own agents were swept up in the pacification."
"So we assumed that Presley's defenses had been completely replaced," Kyle concluded. "Assumptions were risky things, but at least this time, intelligence had erred on the side of caution." "Do we know anything about the current situation on Ambrose?"
"Very little. We've managed to get our hands on the Pacification Corps reports, but..."
"But those are a garbled mess of bullshit, because even the Commonwealth would have to prosecute if half of what those bastards did became public knowledge," he finished for her. "The good news is that we can handle 8 Zions," he told his staff and captains.
The bad news is that if they're run by PC crews, they are not going to surrender.
The pacification corps was staffed with fanatics and psychopaths. Officially, they didn't exist, simply being regular Marine Corps units with some organic Navy support. In practice, they were the counter-argument to revolution. Brute squads sent in to restore order by any means necessary. Most of those means were illegal by Commonwealth law, something the Senate turned a blind eye to and was careful to make sure nobody else found out about. Since those means were also illegal by interstellar law, the Pacification Corps weren't known for surrendering to outside forces either.
"We will engage the platforms at maximum range with missiles," Kyle concluded. "I'm not certain we want to get involved in the situation on the surface, but we can carry out our mission without doing so."
"Most likely, the Corps has secured control of the underwater cities by threatening to breach the domes," Vasilev half-whispered. "Any attempt on our part to assist will only make things worse."
"I intend to operate on the assumption that Presley is a Commonwealth system," Kyle told his people. "We will complete our mission and withdraw. The destruction of the Zions and our continued distraction efforts should keep the Commonwealth response to any further events on Ambrose delayed and under strength. Intentionally trying to make contact with the locals puts them at a risk we cannot provide any reasonable return for," he admitted. "We could potentially take Ambrose with their assistance, but we can't stay. So it would do them no good whatsoever."
"It would probably make things worse," Vasilev pointed out. "Presley is too far into Commonwealth territory for the Alliance to be able to protect them. Any attempt to liberate the system will end poorly for them."
"So we won't," Kyle said. "We move in as planned, we move out as planned. No complications." Reloaded and rearmed before leaving Starkhaven, 41st Fleet's warships adjusted their courses, each ship changing her alignment to line up the largest number of missile launchers with the defensive platforms. It would change the final arrival time of the missiles by only fractions of a second, but those fractions of a second could make all the difference to the survival of the missile that destroyed a target. Almost 180 missiles flashed away, flying toward a mere 8 targets. Targets that didn't react.
"Shouldn't they be doing something?" Sterling asked. "I mean, without their starfighters, they don't have the missile defense to survive that salvo."
"They should have already launched," Kyle realized aloud. "We've been in system for 30 minutes. They can't have missed us." It was an over 40-minute flight time for the missiles. But still, the defensive platforms should have reacted by now.
"Is there any sign that they know we're here?" the Admiral asked.
"None,"
his chief of staff replied after a few moments.
"They don't even have fighters in space. It's like they didn't see us arrive, let alone launch missiles."
"That's impossible. What are they playing at?" Kyle replied. "Get our fighters into space," he ordered. "I can't help feeling we're walking into a trap." Elysium trembled underneath him as her launch tubes came to life, firing starfighters into space with abandon. Hundreds of the tiny ships took up formation around his fleet, a shield against a hidden enemy Kyle couldn't help but suspect was there somewhere. The Presley system was one of the few where someone could hide, after all. But nothing. There was no reaction. The Alliance fleet spent 40 minutes on high alert, watching their missiles flash across the 2 light minutes between them and Ambrose, and then watching them slam home. 8 starfighter launch platforms died in massive balls of fire that would be visible from the surface without even a twitch to suggest they'd seen their death coming.
"Sir," Vasilev interjected in her soft voice, "we're being contacted from the surface. It's via the Commonwealth Q-Probe network, but it's one of our covert operations authentication codes."
Kyle sighed. No complications was starting to look like a pipe dream. "Put them through." An icon of a holographic swimming dolphin appeared in front of him, and a calm voice greeted him.
"Alliance Commander, this is Green Dolphin, let's call me. I speak for Open Ocean, the organization dedicated to the freedom of Ambrose and the Presley system." I received this authentication code from a Coraline Imperium intelligence agent who is unfortunately now dead. The pacification core killed him, along with every other rebel and intelligence operative they could catch, and a few thousand innocents they threw in for good measure.
That was consistent with what little the Alliance knew of the core's operations. Break a few eggs to make an omelet summed up their methodology.
As you may have guessed by now, we have taken control of the planetary scanner sensor and its communications.
The dolphin laughed in a way that Kyle was relatively sure the real animal physically couldn't.
If they'd thought to use their own sensors, they'd have seen you coming, but they decided to rely on the Q-probe net entirely,
Green Dolphin concluded.
So far, the surface forces only know that the Zions are gone. We are moving in to secure the planetary command center as I speak, but any assistance you can provide could make all of the difference.
Do we have a live channel? Kyle asked.
We have a return frequency, yes,
Vasilev confirmed.
Your orders, sir?
Kyle sighed. Complications, he cursed. Link me through. The green floating dolphin icon returned a moment later. This is Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts, Kyle introduced himself. And while I understand, please realize I am less than enthused to be talking to a virtual projection.
Believe me, Admiral Roberts, there is nothing I would love more than to meet you in person,
Green Dolphin replied.
You have quite the reputation in Commonwealth space. I hope our little contribution to your arrival here was appreciated.
It was, Kyle said cautiously. Understand that my mission here is a counter-industry raid, not a liberation. I am neither authorized nor equipped to help win your revolution.
I didn't expect you to be, Dolphin told him. But we couldn't pass up this opportunity. Right now, the only armed spaceships in the system belong to you. We believe we have neutralized the bombs on our domes, which means we only need your assistance neutralizing the pacification core positions on the surface.
I don't have a ground landing force, Kyle warned the rebel, and only limited safe ground bombardment capability. One of his bomber squadrons would suffice to render a planet uninhabitable, but there was nothing any of his starfighters could do for ground bombardment. His capital ships had a small supply of special kinetic munitions, like the one he'd used to take out Oswiri's governor. They could fabricate more. There were few simpler systems in their inventory, but their base load was only a few dozen rounds.
We managed to preserve most of the equipment we acquired in the last uprising, Dolphin explained. We have people and guns, and will shortly control the planetary command center. If you can provide us with armored marines and orbital bombardment to deal with major core positions, we can secure the islands in 3 or 4 days, 5 at most.
I'm not sure I can stay that long, Kyle warned. My mission is on a strict timeline, and I cannot leave your orbital industry intact either way. There was a long pause.
We built it once, Dolphin said grimly. Then we built it again after the Commonwealth destroyed it. We can build it a third time. We know we are too far away for the Alliance to protect us, he continued. Our plan is to withdraw our entire population to the domes and demolish the surface spaceports. The underwater domes are highly resilient to orbital bombardment and a nightmare to try and take with ground troops. Once everyone is below water, Ambrose will be far too expensive for the Commonwealth to try and retake.
That leaves you hiding underwater for a long time, Kyle noted.
Most of us have already lived under the ocean. The rest will learn. Given the choice between never seeing the sky and being shot by the pacification core, we know our course.
Kyle waited, considering.
Please, Admiral Roberts, the Dolphin finally said. Please help us. I know we're still asking a lot, but with your help, we can be free. Without it, we may have just got a whole lot of people killed for nothing.
Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts sighed. When you put it like that. We'll be in orbit in a few hours, he promised. If you'll help us coordinate the evacuation of the orbital platforms to the underwater domes as well, we will help you secure your planet. But we must then withdraw.
I know. Thank you.
Chapter 25. Niagara System. 1500, September 23rd, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. BB-285, St. Michael. About the only good news out of the mess was that it appeared that James's analysis department had their heads on straight.
Do we have any fucking clue what crawled up Brigadier Morrison's ass that caused him to ignore a goddamn battle fleet?
The Marshal of the Rimward Marches snarled at the virtual conference.
Anyone! Anything!
General Coelho isn't responding to any attempts at communication,
Corna said grimly.
What intelligence I've been able to dig out from secondary sources suggests that the entire planetary communication net has been compromised, and that 35th Corps' planetary command center has been taken by rebels.
James Walkingstick grunted. He was reasonably sure he knew exactly what 35th Corps' job on Ambrose had been, but even he wasn't entirely certain the rumored pacification corps existed. Certainly, 35th Corps had been sent to Ambrose to secure it against a second revolt, which was suggestive to anyone who believed those rumors.
Which means that Morrison is dead,
James concluded.
Blown to bits with his defense platforms, and Coelho is either dead or captured.
Which meant dead. Whether 35th Corps was guilty of the crimes James suspected or not, there was no way the commander of the occupying garrison would have survived capture.
And Ambrose is in open revolt,
Corna confirmed.
We have no contact with any organized formations on the planet, but what I'm getting from intelligence sources is that the rebels came out of the woodwork with weapons acquired from the garrison they wiped out in the first uprising. They don't have the gear to deal with any of the hardpoints, so I have no idea how they took the planetary command center. But they have the numbers and the gear that it probably won't take more than 24 hours to push 35th Corps back into their secured positions.
And with an Alliance fleet in orbit, those secured positions won't hold long,
Vasek pointed out. The shaven-headed admiral linked in via QCOM.
I have to wonder if all of this wasn't a ploy to get us looking somewhere else while they took control of Ambrose.
Unlikely, James replied. His raids made us putting together something like your task force inevitable, Joanna. If they'd just moved in and punched out the Presley system's defenders with the help of the rebels, they'd have had weeks to make sure we couldn't take the system. No, this is the rebels taking advantage of a golden opportunity,
the Marshal concluded grimly, yanking on his braid.
And they've handed us a glorious trap. What's your ETA to visual, Admiral Vasek?
36 more hours, she said instantly.
And from there, 4 light-years and 4 days to Presley,
Corna pointed out.
If the rebels convince Roberts to help them, he'll probably still be there.
5.5 days, James considered aloud. Not sure I'd be willing to stay that long in his place. He knows the risks of letting us catch him.
Vasek cleared her throat.
I have discussed the situation with several key navigation officers aboard my fleet, she told them. Presley is sufficiently close to our vector to visual that they believe they can adjust our course and get us there without slowing down. Our current pseudo-velocity is 1.5 light-years per day. They estimate it will take 12 hours of extremely careful adjustments to get us on course, and 3.5 days to get to Presley. 4 days total, from now.
James winced.
That is phenomenally dangerous, Admiral,
he pointed out. You couldn't see anything from inside an Alcubierre Stetson bubble. Nothing outside it could see you either. Your course was set before you left, based on up-to-date information on your destination, relayed through QCOM networks and massive interpolating calculations. Changing course in mid-flight was based on the worst kind of dead reckoning, and could result in you overshooting and trying to emerge from warped space inside a star. The risks were high, but the rewards... Vasek had 18 ships. None were as large or as powerful as Roberts's ships, but they carried modern fighters, bombers, and missiles. They could take the raiding fleet.
It is,
Vasek agreed levelly.
But my people think they can do it, and stopping this bastard before he blasts any more systems industry to pieces is worth the risk.
James sighed, studying the chart on his wall, then nodded slowly.
I won't order it, Admiral, he said levelly. And you won't, either. If you don't get all of your captains and navigators to sign off on it, it's a no-go. Understood?
Understood, she replied, her voice equally level.
But if they do, kill that son of a bitch for me, Admiral Vasek.
Chapter 26. Presley System. 1200, September 24th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. Kyle watched with hard eyes as the explosions stomped their way along the foot of the mountain range. The Terran Commonwealth Marines 35th Corps' 3rd Division had dug themselves in along the base of Ambrose's only mountain range, a set of stony spires that split Golden, the largest island on the planet, in half. Of the 5 divisions on the planet, 3rd had made the most of a name for itself among the locals. As soon as the revolt had started, 3rd Division's units had executed a clearly pre-planned maneuver, abandoning their barracks and prisons in favor of pre-built heavy fortifications in the mountains. Footage from the militias that had broken into those empty facilities had eliminated Kyle's last vestiges of hesitation. It had been over a year since the revolt, but there were fresh bodies hanging from the gallows in the barracks' courtyards and prison entryways. Even the rebels didn't have any estimates of how many people the pacification corps had killed. Certainly, the Alliance ground troops who'd broken into 35th Corps' bases hadn't found any records of their executions. 3rd Division had known they couldn't hold the cities and towns, not against an enraged populace out for blood. They had, however, thought they would be the ones with orbital fire support. If the rebels had been forced to attack the fortifications along the Golden Mountains base, they would have died in their thousands. Even with power armor, any assault would have been a massacre, and with the Zions in orbit to provide fire support, the division would have been almost untouchable. Instead, however, 41st Fleet held the orbitals, and kinetic rounds marched along the line of fortifications, collapsing caverns and shattering bunkers. Over 90% of Kyle's bombardment munitions had been allocated to this strike. His logistics ships were already capturing convenient asteroids to turn into more. It was going to be a long few days.
Bombardment complete, Captain Novak reported. If there's a single intact facility down there, our scanners can't pick it up.
Have Major Constantine's Marines sweep it with assault shuttles at low altitude, Kyle ordered. Jane Constantine was the commander of Elysium's Marine Battalion, and the woman with the misfortune of being the senior ground force officer in 41st Fleet. There'd been no plans for landing in the operation, after all.
Understood, Novak confirmed. What's the next stage?
From our discussions with Open Ocean, we get Golden clear of hostiles, and then start island hopping, Kyle replied. A good third of the populace is on Golden, so that will give them a head start on evacuating them to the domes.
His flag captain shook her head. Do they have enough space in the domes for another couple 100 million people? She asked.
I have no idea, he admitted. If nothing else, they have the tools to build more domes, but... Kyle sighed. Given how harsh the fighting has been down there, I understand why they think the Commonwealth won't want to pay the cost to take them back. Because of the breaching charges mounted on the dome's exteriors, only 2 of the Pacification Corps divisions had been in the underwater domes. 20,000 soldiers against 500 million very angry people. About half of them had promptly surrendered. The troops in the domes had been the least actively vicious of the occupying force. They'd had a big enough stick backing them up that they hadn't needed to be.
Eternal Void,
Aurangzeb suddenly cursed, the operations officer's voice echoing across the flag deck. What is it? Kyle demanded. Aurangzeb was silent and white-faced, but he flipped what he was seeing to Kyle's implant feed. A spike of energy under the oceans. A thermonuclear charge, Kyle recognized half-absently, smothered by over a kilometer of water, He closed his eyes. It didn't stop the implant feed, but it at least made him feel better.
Which? He coughed to clear his throat. Which one? He asked. New Carpathia, Aurangzeb finally responded. The Terran's 3543 Brigade was holding out, but their positions were being overrun. They apparently got around the lockout on the charges. Or had another nuke in their stockpile, Kyle said quietly. How many? 6 million people, give or take, his ops officer said. It depends on whether any of the internal systems held. With a nuke against the exterior of the dome, though. Almost certainly not, the admiral confirmed. Record everything, he snarled. Every piece of footage from their god's accursed barracks and prisons. Every scrap of data on that bomb. We'll dump everything we find into the interstellar data feeds. Let the Commonwealth pretend the pacification core is only slanderous rumors then.
It took another full day to fully secure Golden, running out Kyle's original 48-hour planned stay. They'd evacuated most of the orbital platform's population to Golden itself, turning Ambrose's largest island into a massive transit depot. Shuttles landed from the space stations, offloaded their cargoes of confused and often terrified civilians, and then returned to orbit as surprisingly organized collections of ragtag militia in green armbands corralled them, guiding them toward the fleets of submersibles that would take them to safety.
We're running out of time, Dolphin, Kyle warned their contact.
So far as he could tell, the colored dolphins were the senior dozen or so members of Open Ocean, the survivors of the men and women who'd coordinated the original uprising. The organization and preparedness of Ambrose's revolution were down to them, and they were being very careful that not even the most friendly admiral in orbit was going to know who they were.
41st Fleet needs to be on our way, he told Green Dolphin. Our ops plan called for us to spend a maximum of 60 hours here.
We've still got an entire division and a half of pacification corps troops dug in across the planet, Dolphin replied. We need your help still. At least 100 million people still need to be evacuated.
And are we going to pay with 6 million lives for every day this continues? Kyle asked gently.
The dolphin icon shivered.
I pray not, he said. Give me another 3 days, Admiral. Please, give us 3 of your support, and I'll have hidden everyone underwater. We've secured the domes, removed the remaining charges. There should be no more mass murders.
And what happens when you have 800 million people crammed into domes meant for 500, Kyle said. I don't know how much help I can be.
That's been handled, the rebel spokesperson told him. There are domes the Commonwealth doesn't know about, and expansions we've kept hidden. We have the space and we have the life support for everyone. All we need is to get the damn Commonwealth troops out of the way, and we won't get that done fast enough without your help, Admiral Roberts.
Kyle exhaled a long sigh, then nodded.
72 more hours, he told Dolphin. There's only a pair of ships at Vigil. Anything else will need at least 4 more days, even if they left as soon as we arrived here. But after that, we need to be gone. I sympathize with Open Ocean's cause, but I can't fight an open fleet battle for you.
I understand that, Admiral. We thank you for your aid.
You'd better, Kyle said with an only semi-forced grin. Now, Mr. Dolphin, where do you need my Marines next?
It's a risk, Sterling pointed out. A big one. We don't know for sure where all of Walking Stick's ships are. If he'd moved a smaller force into this region for a nodal defense, they could be a lot closer than we're expecting.
Vigil is closest, Kyle replied. They're 4 days away with 2 Paramount-class carriers. Nobody is going to send 2 Paramounts against this fleet, people.
But they might have reinforced Vigil. We don't know, Vasilev admitted. The communication lockdown is working against us now. We've sent a bunch of agents dark for their own protection, and Command can't send us up-to-date intelligence for what we've got.
We have to take the risk, Kyle told them with a sigh.
800 million people.
These sons of bitches blew up 6 million innocents to try and stop this rebellion. We're not even sure how many died in the uprising or in the Pacification Corps' occupation. We can't guarantee their safety, but they had a plan for that. He shook his head. We can give them 5 days, people. We can't give them any more than that. By hour 120, we will be on our way out.
It's costing us Marines, Aurangzeb pointed out grimly. We've lost over 200 so far. We're throwing maybe 2 brigades worth of Marines against entire divisions in dug-in positions.
Our fabricators are keeping up with the need for bombardment projectiles so far, Kyle replied.
We'll keep hammering the bastards from orbit. Our people are the stiffening to the rebels. Which means they're the tip of the spear, his ops officer told him. We'll lose more, Admiral.
And if we ask them to volunteer, do you think a single one of our Marines would refuse? Kyle demanded. Would any of our people?
Aurangzeb sighed. No, sir.
We're in this war to protect our own people, yes, Kyle reminded his staff. But we can't turn away from people in need of help. Not and stay true to ourselves. Not and stay true to our honor. That said, you're right that there's a risk. It's entirely possible that there are ships closer than we think, and we need to be ready for that possibility.
A broad grin spread across his face.
I have some thoughts, he concluded. I suggest we get the rest of the captains and CAGs in on this. We might be caught by surprise, but I refuse to be caught unprepared.
Chapter 27. Presley System. 1600, September 27th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. Alliance 41st Fleet.
Pandora Isle is secure, Major Constantine reported, her voice strained. No prisoners, no...
She sighed.
Nothing left, she admitted.
Where do they find these motherfuckers? Entire towns leveled by artillery. My people can't even count the dead. We evac'd maybe 20,000 people, and there might be another 20,000 in the towns we haven't reached or in hiding. This island was supposed to have 80,000 people, sir.
Kyle winced. The rumors and horror stories about the Commonwealth's Pacification Corps were paling in comparison to the reality his people were now encountering. But no one had ever successfully taken a planet away from them before. Everything combined totaled far less than the one destructive moment when they'd blown New Carpathia's dome. But so much of the killing had been so much more personal.
How are your people holding up? He asked.
So far, so good, Constantine told him. But...
But?
I strongly recommend that these troops are not deployed against Commonwealth forces again until they've spent some time in counseling.
All of them. Including me, she admitted.
After this, void shit. I can't guarantee we wouldn't do something we'd regret.
Understood, Major, Kyle replied. 1,000 times over. His father had been a Marine in the last war and had ended up one of exactly 7 suicides from post-traumatic stress disorder in the Federation afterward. Modern counseling was good, but you had to get it before it could help.
I'll make sure it happens, he promised.
It was probably going to require a major interruption in the ops plan to take the Marines back to Alliance space and find new ones, but he owed it to his people. And if this mess wasn't going to distract the Commonwealth, nothing was.
How much longer? He asked.
Pandora was the last significant core presence, Constantine told him. There are still major groupings of civilians for the locals to evacuate, but all that's left are scattered companies and platoons now. We'll coordinate with Open Ocean, but we should have the last of the Corps swept up inside 36 hours.
You don't have 36 hours, Kyle warned her. We need to be on our way in 24. Less, preferably.
She sighed and nodded.
We can clean up the major forces by then, she promised. We're past the point where orbital bombardment is going to help anyway. The locals can deal with the last few platoons if we make sure there's no power armor left on this damned rock.
They'll have to, he said grimly. The clock is ticking.
Sir!
Aurangzeb's voice interrupted his conversation.
Alcubierre emergencies! Multiple Alcubierre emergencies!
Kyle's smile twisted.
It seems, Major, that the clock has run out. Deal with the pacification corps. This mess is my problem.
Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts turned his attention back to the feed in time for space itself to explode in front of his fleet. A ball of fire the size of the planet behind him, lighting up a temporary new sun in the Presley system, barely a light minute from Ambrose.
"What the hell was that?" Sterling demanded.
Kyle winced as the data on the explosion ran through his feed, and traded a look with his flag captain.
"You tell him," he ordered Captain Novak.
"That, Senior Fleet Commander, is why threading the needle is the last resort of the deranged and the desperate," she said gently, "and why you don't change course in a warped space bubble. Someone overshot, hit the needle, and fell off on the wrong side of caution."
It had started as the regular pulse of Cherenkov radiation, and then had turned into the energy release of an entire 10-million-ton-plus warship converting itself to energy, along with its crew.
"Eternal stars," Aurangzeb breathed. That
was a starship," Kyle finished for him. "And it's one we're not going to have to fight, unlike their friends. What do we have, Ops?"
Senior Fleet Commander Zartosht Aurangzeb shook himself, focusing on his duty to put away the terror of what he'd just seen.
"Commonwealth warships," he stated the obvious. "I've got 17 ships left, I suppose. Mostly reading in the 30 to 50 million cubic range, but I think there may be a couple of 25 million cubic meter ships out there."
"Nail down the details," Kyle ordered. "So no saints, no volcanoes, but there's a God's accursed difference in threat level between 17 Resolute-class battleships or 17 Lexington-class carriers with a proper ratio of bombers."
"We're working on it," Aurangzeb promised.
Kyle left them to it, focusing on the feed and linking in with his captains.
"All right, people, it looks like we ran out the clock," he said grimly. "We've got 8,000 Marines on the surface, so we aren't running. That means we have to fight, and Walking Stick has sent a fleet with the hulls and starfighters to give us a run for our money. One of the poor bastards overshot, and that may have taken the odds from screwed to even, so let's not waste it. Formation Alpha 1. Let's head out to meet them, people."
"What about the starfighters?" Bial asked.
Kyle smiled.
"They have their own job."
"Will the radiation be damaging on the surface?"
Green Dolphin asked, the voice behind the holographic icon clearly concerned.
"No," Kyle told him. "Anything with a planetary-scale electromagnetic field or a military-grade electromagnetic deflector will be fine."
The electromagnetic deflectors on his starships and starfighters, after all, were intended to deflect focused beams of charged antimatter. Even a solar megaflare or the self-annihilation of an Alcubierre drive starship paled in comparison to that threat.
"That's good, I suppose,"
the representative of the organization that was now, basically, Ambrose's government replied.
"What about non-military ships?"
Kyle winced.
"Let's just say it's a damn good thing we'd evacuated your orbital platforms," he said quietly. "And, well, I'm probably not going to bother blowing them up now."
Once the radiation wave swept over the exotic matter refineries, coil growth facilities, and other advanced, high-tech manufacturing facilities in Ambrose orbit, none of their sensitive electronics and systems were going to be functional. Most likely, even their airlocks were going to be fused shut. Actually, destroying the space stations would be almost pointless now. While it would be cheaper to restore the facilities than to build new space stations, it would take almost as long as building new manufacturing facilities. That part of his mission was apparently complete. Now, however.
"We didn't expect the Commonwealth to respond so quickly," Dolphin said quietly. "The numbers don't look good. I'm sorry."
Kyle snorted. He'd known from the beginning that Open Ocean's revolt was effectively, though unintentionally, a trap for his fleet. He'd tried to evade it by setting a time limit, but he'd guessed wrong.
It isn't as bad as the numbers look, he told the civilian. My ships are bigger and more advanced than theirs, though the fighter balance isn't as heavily in my favor as I'd like. No, this fight had to happen sooner or later, Dolphin. This way, I at least get to set the terms of engagement. Plus, they blew up one of their own ships getting to me.
Is there any way we can assist?
Finish your evacuations and help my Marines get ready to move out, Kyle told him. This part is mine.
Then I shall get out of your hair, Admiral.
Good luck. ECM drones flared out around Kyle's fleet, concealing starships and starfighters alike from the incoming enemy. His formation shook out with calm practice. With three star system invasions under their belt, his crews were comfortable with themselves and their admiral now. He'd organized his fleet into a rough cube, with a five-ship wall of battleships and battlecruisers forming the front face of the cube, and a second five-ship wall of carriers bringing up the rear. 100 Falcon starfighters formed a protective screen in front of the battle wagons, helping keep Presley's ever-present rocks from interfering with the formation.
We have a count, Aurangzeb told him over the tactical feed. Better than it could have been, but we still might be in trouble.
Kyle nodded wordlessly, trusting the implant link to carry the intent to his subordinate.
Three battleships, all Resolute class, his ops officer started. Older battle wagons, but still heavy hitters. No starfighters, but big lances and lots of missiles. Three strike cruisers, all ocean class. Nothing special about them. 60 fighters, a dozen launchers, bugger all for offensive lances. Six carriers. Four are Lexingtons, but two are Paramounts. That's the good news. They've got starfighters and bombers, but none of those six have missiles or lances worth mentioning. Four battlecruisers, including the Joker in the deck, Aurangzeb concluded. One Hercules-class battlecruiser, presumably the flagship. Rest are assassins.
Kyle nodded again, then smiled viciously.
I'm almost insulted, he said aloud, making sure his voice was carried over the bridge and fleet link as well. We spend a month poking holes in the Commonwealth's vulnerable spots, and this is all Walking Stick has to send us? His second string of ships he wouldn't trust in a real fight?
The truth was a bit more complex, and he knew his people knew it. But there was a solid core of confidence to his intentionally boisterous enthusiasm. 17 second-rate ships were a real threat to his fleet, but one they could almost certainly defeat. The problem, of course, was the Commonwealth commander was almost certainly running the same calculation and coming up with a different answer. The cold calculus of war suggested one of them was getting their inputs wrong, but there was only one way to find out.
41st Fleet will move to engage the enemy, Kyle told his crews.
Chapter 28. Presley System. 1800, September 27th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date, Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. 27 Alcubierre Stetson Drive capital ships maneuvered toward each other through Presley's debris-filled voids. Few systems in the human sphere could assemble that many warships. Even the Sol System's immense economy could fund only a handful of warships without bankrupting itself. Fleets of this scale took multi-stellar nation-states, not a single system. Whatever happened here today, Kyle was grimly certain Presley was about to see more than its annual economic output destroyed.
They're playing it cautious so far, Captain Novak noted. Starfighters moved forward about 2 million kilometers and are holding position there.
She paused.
Missile launch, she reported calmly. 170 inbound.
She shook her head.
New birds too, Admiral. 1050 Gs.
Understood. Kyle studied the screen for a moment, then smiled again. Let's return the favor. Senior Fleet Commander Aurangzeb.
Sir,
his ops officer responded crisply.
All ships are to target the Hercules and launch missiles, Kyle ordered.
They'd have a better chance of taking out, say, the Paramounts, but with the carrier starfighters already in space, the old ship's real role in this fight was already over. More missile icons speckled the display. The range was still nearly 2 light minutes, well out of range of any other weapon system in either fleet's arsenal.
The capital ship missiles could make the distance, though each salvo was the cost of an entire starfighter squadron.
"Are we limiting salvos, sir?"
Novak asked. With the price tag of starship missiles, there were only so many of the weapons aboard the fleet. "No," he told her, then linked in the rest of the captains. "Empty the magazines, captains. I have no intention of holding back anything in our first real fleet action. We'll pull back to Via Somnia after this to rearm and replenish our stocks. For now, let's give our new friends everything we've got." Acknowledgements came back over the link, and a second salvo blazed out. Most of his ships carried 100 missiles per launcher with a cycle time of a bit under a minute. By the time the first salvos arrived, he'd have 35 more salvos in space following them. They'd be through the Commonwealth fleet before they could actually empty their magazines. His people knew what he meant, though. Most fleet actions were decided by starfighters, and this one would be no different. But if he wanted the enemy to think he was courting a true ship-to-ship action, he had to play the game. Despite the phenomenal acceleration and speed of missiles and starships, space combat still took time. Lots of it. From the moment the missiles first launched to their reaching the range of the starfighter screen in front of each fleet was over 30 minutes. Those Falcons and Arrows dedicated for missile defense swarmed around the incoming missiles, lasers and positron lances flashing desperately. The capital ships behind them had been watching the missiles coming for half an hour themselves, and their own lasers and defensive positron lances opened up as well. None of the missiles made it through. But the second salvo had been launched with that touch more velocity and that touch less far to go. The gap between their arrival was less than the gap between their launch times. Each salvo came closer than the one before it, the line of explosions marching closer to his fleet. Their own salvos weren't even getting as close as the Commonwealth's. The attacker's fighter screen was far denser, with over 800 starfighters formed into a solid defensive screen in front of the Terran fleet. It was costing them starfighters, but it was stopping every one of the Alliance missiles. And the Alliance's own defense was costing them starfighters as well. Kyle watched the icons flash red and disappear off his feeds with a forced level expression. He'd once been in a starfighter that had been too close to a successfully stopped missile. He'd lived, but his crew hadn't. And he'd been grounded forever. "Are we at Point Turkey yet?" he asked quietly.
"Negative," Sterling replied. "Another 3 minutes and counting."
So far, none of the enemy fire had reached his fleet, but he could only lose so many starfighters from his limited screen before that changed.
"Turkey in 150 seconds. Williams Alvarez, your closest. Call the shot."
Lakatos's voice echoed in Michelle's implant as she rechecked the positions of her fighters.
SFG-012 ready for Turkey, she told him. Ready to call the shot.
The 192 starfighters under her command continued to drift through one of the denser sections of Presley's spread-out asteroid belts. SFG-012 was spread out across about 500,000 kilometers, each starfighter and bomber locked onto a hunk of rock big enough to conceal the 8,000-ton spacecraft. The main use of those hunks of rock and ice was as heat sinks. Every erg of waste energy being produced by 800 Falcons, Vultures, and Arrows was being dumped into Presley's asteroids. With their drives down, their sensors deactivated and their heat dumped into natural objects big enough to absorb it, 41st Fleet's fighter force was functionally invisible. They were also spread out across an arc some 10 million kilometers wide. They'd been positioned based on the theory that any fleet had to be coming from Niagara, but that still left them with a lot of space to cover. Michelle checked. Her entire fighter group, bombers and starfighters alike, was going to be in range. Of the rest, well, most of the bombers would be in range for the torpedoes. Everyone else was going to have to close the range. The sucker punch was on her.
"That Hercules is getting pounded by radiation, even if none of the fleet's missiles have hit her yet," she observed to her people. "Vrubel, one squadron only against the Hercules, then the Resolutes, then the closer Assassins, one squadron each."
As she spoke, Wing Commander Dusanov Rubel updated the targeting parameters for her bomber wing, forwarding the data back to Michelle. 8 bombers on each of the battleships and the modern battlecruiser. That left 1 battlecruiser, the strike cruisers and the carriers unengaged. Alpha Wing, you're with me on the last assassin. Bravo Wing, Charlie Wing, Delta Wing, each of you takes a strike cruiser.
What about the carriers, ma'am?
This bunch of obsolete trash doesn't even have missile launchers, Michelle replied, keeping her voice as dismissive as possible. Take out the escorts, and they'll know the game is up. Seconds ticked by as she waited for a response.
Turkey in 30 seconds, Lakatos told her quietly. The call is yours, Vice Commodore. Everyone else will close in your wake.
Understood, she replied levelly, checking the time and the position of the Commonwealth fleet hurtling toward her little section of space. If they hadn't been using QCOMs, the entire conversation would have risked their stealth. The lead formation of Terran starfighters was already past them. Turkey shoot in 15 seconds, she declared over the all-ships channel. Let's go bag us some starships. Point Turkey was a moving target, the point in space and time where the Commonwealth warships were in range of the most Alliance starfighters. The computers aboard the starfighter force were constantly recalculating it, factoring in the boot-up time of the fighter's engines, the initiation cycle for the launch systems, and every other variable they'd been told to look for. The final call, however, always belonged to a human. The computers and AIs supporting Michelle allowed her to slow her apparent time, letting tenths of a second drip by like glaciers, watching for the exact moment to strike. The 15 seconds she'd announced passed, then 15 and a half seconds, then 16.
Turkey, turkey, turkey! Break and attack! Michelle barked over the tactical network.
She suited actions to words as well, triggering her Falcon's engines and tearing the agile starfighter from the lump of ice and metal she'd attached it to. The asteroid came apart under the heat of her engines, with a couple of millisecond-long pre-programmed pulses from her positron lance helping clear the way. Her target was the Assassin-class battlecruiser currently 100,000 kilometers away, but flashing past her at 8,000 kilometers a second. The Paramount carrier 20,000 kilometers away hadn't been in her plans. The carrier was old and obsolete. She had no business in a frontline battle, but her defensive positron lances were fully functional, and age left her with at least some crew who'd served on her for over a decade. Even as Michelle's missiles blasted free of her fighter's hull toward the approaching assassin, the Paramount's lances were already flaring to life. 2 of her bombers died before they could launch. Another trio of Falcons died just after launching. Old as the ship was, she was in the wrong place at the wrong time and proving far too dangerous. But she was also in lance range of the starfighters, and Michelle sent a wordless command to her flight crews as she took her own fighter forward in a spiraling charge, her Falcon's positron lance flaring to life again as she closed with the old starship. Others followed her, and the Paramount class's major flaw was a complete lack of armor. She predated the multi-layered ablative ceramic armor that modern warships carried to stand off beams of pure antimatter, and post-dated the sandwich neutronium armor that pre-positron lance warships had carried. The 50 kiloton a second beams sliced through with horrifying ease, sending pieces of the carrier spinning off into space. Torpedoes and starfighter missiles were exploding all around Michelle, her second salvo flashing out at the same battlecruiser as before as she brought her Falcon up to its full acceleration, burning past the Commonwealth fleet. One of the Resolutes lurched across her path. The battleship had taken at least one torpedo hit, but her size and armor meant she was still in the fight, her defensive lances reaping a vicious harvest of Michelle's subordinates and friends. She triggered her positron lance again, slashing the beam of pure antimatter across the entire length of the Terran battleship. It lurched again, losing atmosphere and weapons from her blow, and then a salvo of starfire missiles flashed in from the other starfighters. A cascade of explosions obliterated the battleship. And then she was through, spinning her fighter in space to unleash a final salvo of missiles after the surviving starships, no longer charging 41st Fleet so much as fleeing the starfighters that had ravaged their ranks. Somehow, despite everything, the Hercules had survived. Of the cruisers and battleships, though, she was the only survivor, and only one Paramount and two Lexingtons still accompanied her. 13 Commonwealth capital ships had died in under a minute, and Michelle allowed herself a moment of vicious celebration. Then she looked at the Alliance's losses. Kyle stood on his flag deck and tried to continue to appear calm as the numbers rolled in. The Commonwealth fleet had been functionally destroyed, but their starfighters remained in play, hurtling toward his fleet at over 5% of light speed. They were leaving the battered trio of capital ships behind and accelerating at their full speed now. 1,100 bombers and starfighters, and all he had was the 200 he'd kept behind for missile defense. He'd lost over a third of the starfighters at Point Turkey. Heavier losses than he'd hoped for, but in exchange for an even more significant victory than he'd hoped for. But the 500 starfighters and bombers from that strike were now well behind the Terrans, and opening the distance at a combined 700 gravities. His cube formation continued forward as he tried to calculate some way to turn the odds, now hugely in his favor, into a battle that wouldn't result in lost capital ships on his side.
"Sterling, get me a broad radio transmission at the Commonwealth," he finally ordered.
He couldn't see a way to fight the Commonwealth without taking further losses, but he'd already shattered their morale. It was possible.
"Forces of the Terran Commonwealth," he focused his gaze on the pickup. "You know who I am."
That was egotistical. It was entirely possible that there were pilots and officers over there who didn't know his reputation, or only knew it by the name of the Stellar Fox. Anyone who didn't recognize him would be quickly informed by their implants, however. No one would have been sent to this front without a database of Alliance senior officers, after all.
"This is no longer a battle you can survive."
His missiles were continuing to pound the remaining three capital ships. Even with the fighter screen, that wasn't a barrage a crippled battlecruiser and two old carriers could survive for long.
"I will freely admit that you can still hurt my fleet," he told them. "Perhaps even enough that the Commonwealth would claim this as a victory. But your capital ships will not survive. The planet behind me is hostile to you. Even if you were to destroy my fleet, you would all die before relief could arrive. Your only hope of survival is to negotiate with me. If you surrender, I will arrange for you to be rescued and delivered to a safe prison camp on the surface of Ambrose, where the Commonwealth can negotiate your retrieval with the new local government."
It would delay him, but not enough for another fleet of this scale to reach Presley. And if he could end this fight now, that would be worth it.
"You have," he checked the time in his implant, 15 minutes from your receipt of this message to make a decision. Any starfighter safety pod that is ejected will be regarded as having accepted my offer, regardless of the status of the rest of the fleet."
He smiled grimly. "Enough people have died today. Don't make me kill the rest of you." Kyle wasn't really surprised that no one took him up on it. By the time his deadline expired, all three capital ships were floating debris, but the starfighters continued on their determined course. "There are days I wish the Commonwealth military had the moral courage equivalent to their leadership," he said dryly.
"Keep the missiles flying. If you can pick out the bombers, well, you know what to do."
4 minutes until they're in torpedo range," Aurangzeb told him calmly. "Gunners are vectoring missiles as best they can, but we're still looking at 1,000 fighters in space when they reach range. No idea how many bombers."
Both the katanas and the longbows had powerful ECM systems. Telling the difference at this range was all but impossible, and any Q-probe that got close enough to have a chance was also close enough to be detected and destroyed.
"Move the carriers forward into the wall," he ordered. "We'll want every lance and laser emitter synced together when those torpedoes arrive."
The wall of warships spread out as the second layer of the cube adjusted their course, filling in newly opening gaps between the battlecruisers and battleships. Defensive lances and lasers continued to flicker through space, picking off the last orphaned missiles from the Commonwealth starships.
"Torpedo range," Sterling reported.
It was almost unnecessary, as the tactical feeds lit up with hundreds of the mid-sized missiles. Not as capable as all-up capital ship missiles with their hour-long flight times, but still smarter and longer-ranged than the lighter